Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Pixel Drone Show, the show where we talk to industry professionals about how they use their drones. And our guest today, I'm excited, is Basil Yap. And Basil is we met through a friend of mine that I went to college with, Chris Fernando. I know he'll like having his name mentioned. And Basil is the Beyond Program Manager for the North Carolina DOT. He's also the Vice President for HAFCON Consulting. And Basil, by trade, is a civil engineer. We won't hold that against him, but he's also a podcast host for the No U-Turn podcast, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And you can hear, you'll hear in a second, he has a voice for radio. So Basil, welcome to the show.
Yeah, a lot of pressure now with the voice for radio. But yeah, I really appreciate being on here and have appreciated watching this particular show, and very insightful. So yeah, excited to chat with you guys today.
Awesome. Well, before we dive into all the cool things you've been doing recently with drones and the aviation industry in general, can you tell us how you got involved with aviation in the first place?
Well, I always have had a passion for aviation. It's funny, one of my first memories I have is sitting on my grandfather's lap watching a propeller spin up. And this was when we were living in Hawaii. And aviation was a big part of flying between the islands. And so that's one of my earliest memories, and have just always had a passion for aviation. So when I was in high school, worked at an airport, always loved going to air shows. And as you noted, I went to school to become a civil engineer. And when I was going through that program, traditionally you think of civil engineers as building roads and bridges. And, you know, I don't know if this happened to you guys, but you get 2-3 years into a program, you're like, why am I even in this program anymore? And so I was really fortunate to have an internship with the North Carolina Department of Transportation within their aviation division. And so they primarily focus on building funding the development of airports. And so then that was one way to kind of use my degree to get back into this space. And so really kind of got back into helping airports, both large and small, grow and maintain them. And then it turns out while I was there at North Carolina DOT, an opportunity arose to help start the UAS program there for North Carolina. And at that point, I'd never flown a drone before in my life. And we were working with some folks in the state, including NC State. And so the North Carolina legislature had asked them to, you know, start this drone program and some other items they needed and tasks they had to do. And they didn't have anyone to really start that, and kind of just volunteered like, hey, I'll do what I'm doing on the airport development side, but also help out on this new drone program. And figured I'd probably need to go fly a drone at that point. And so that's when I really kind of got into drones. And of course, when 2016 rolled around, I was able to get my my drone pilot license. And, you know, at that point, our task was to help kind of develop the entire drone program in North Carolina, including how the department used it, as well as how we attracted commercial, commercial partners. So, yeah, that passion for aviation kind of led, of course, from the airport side over to the drone side.
Awesome. So you are the vice president for, is it HAFCON?
Yep, HAFCON.
HAFCON Consulting. So can you tell me a little bit more, or us a little bit more, about what the company does and what is your involvement?
Yeah, so often I get the question, where did HAFCON come from, that name? And so I'm part, one side of my family is Hawaiian Chinese. The other side of my family is Norwegian. And so it really comes from my Norwegian side of the family. And Hobersland, Norway, is where my great-grandfather left from when he moved to the U.S. And my grandfather was someone I looked up to. And so it's actually short for Hobersland Consulting. So any Norwegians out there Hobersland's a very small town in Norway. But that's HAFCON, and that consulting firm started back in 2016. So as I noted, I was a state employee, full-time state employee, and I decided I wanted to leave and share some of the knowledge I'd learned as a state employee with others. And so I left in 2015, started the consulting firm HoveCon in 2016. And one of my contracts, immediately after that was with NCDOT. And I came back and was an embedded consultant with North Carolina DOT as a UAS program manager. But we expanded over time as well and serve a variety of different state and local governments. So we're, you know, working with Wyoming DOT and a variety of other airports that want to develop programs, airports and local cities. And so that's really the services of HoveCon. If you want to get, you know, a waiver, let's say a beyond visual line of sight bridge inspection waiver, we have the history. We helped NCDOT work with Skydio to get that. Or if you're just looking as a local government and you want to start a drone program, we help build the policy, the procedures, the safety management system, and do the training. So it's a pretty small group. There's about 8 of us right now, but when we're spread out all over. And so, yeah, it's been a really exciting experience to go into the consulting world after being a government employee.
Well, I got another question here. I mean, I was looking at your LinkedIn profile just now, and I saw that besides all those things, you're also part-time involved as a president of ArrowX and then also ArrowX Ventures. Can you tell us a little bit more about those two initiatives?
Well, probably like all of us, if you have a passion for aviation or drones, you kind of you volunteer for a lot of things and you get involved in a lot of things. I think we all want to see this this industry grow. So the nonprofit ArrowX is an initiative in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and that nonprofit is working with local medical partners like Novant Healthcare and Atrium Wake Forest Baptist Hospital. So they have a presence in Winston-Salem. They are using drones and they want to expand that footprint. And so what ArrowX is focused on is really establishing a localized unmanned traffic management system in the city of Winston-Salem. And so we've asked the legislature for some funding, capital investment in a ground-based radar system. And the plan is to then build a safety case so that folks that want to come fly within the city of Winston-Salem, we can partner with them to get them access to a variety of different data, including airspace surveillance through a ground-based radar system, or weather, or other things like GPS integrity, cell coverage, etc. So we're really excited about that initiative. I think what I'm most excited about is that we have these healthcare partners that are really kind of leading leading that charge. So at the end of the day, these guys, you know, they're paying for those services, and that's who you need involved in these conversations.
It is definitely very interesting. Also, I mean, go ahead.
So then you also asked about ArrowX, the venture fund. And so I co-founded that fund with three others. We're the general partners that have, you know, put our own money and are now fundraising toward a goal of about $50 million for this first fund. And we're focused on advanced air mobility. So not only UAS and all the software and manufacturing capability that go along with that, but also looking at air taxis or other kind of automated or autonomous systems on aircraft. So really excited for that to be kind of the next phase for me and focusing my time and effort and hopefully bringing my experience from regulations and some of these other programs to help startups and really let them grow in this space.
I think it's definitely cool. I mean, if you look at the healthcare system and drone deliveries, I mean, we've seen some examples where organs have been transported by drones and as well for COVID samples as well, test samples. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense. In that localized UTM project, is the FAA involved at all in that as well? Or is that something that is run purely local?
No, the FAA, as we know, FAA needs to definitely to be involved. And so the safety case that we're building around, using a ground-based radar system, the FAA is commenting and ultimately we need their buy-off. Last thing you want to do is spend $2 million on a radar system to find out that FAA is like, well, I don't really know if that's the right radar you need to be using. So, at the same time, FAA is not going to give us a thumbs up and a seal of approval if you don't have the equipment and you haven't validated it. So it's definitely a close relationship that we're that we have and that we're continuing to foster to solve this problem. And I think solving it in a kind of a small urban area like Winston-Salem, that has an airport close to the downtown. So part of the airspace is Class D or controlled airspace. And we have active partners already flying. I think that kind of gives us a leg up with FAA.
So speaking of this, let's talk about the IPP, which is the UAS Integration Pilot Program that the FAA created back in, I think it was 2020. And I know you were involved with this with the North Carolina, the DOT. Can you tell us how you were involved, kind of what your team did, and then how you contributed to the program?
Yeah, so the UAS Integration Pilot Program, we had heard rumblings in 2017, you know, that this program was going to come out. And so sure enough, November of, I think, 2017, no, it was October of 2017, at the time, President Trump signed a presidential memorandum to kick this program off. And so we had essentially from the time that memo got signed until, I think it was January 4th, so about 3 months to write a proposal. And so it was a proposal process that you need to submit. And I know there were over 100 submissions that ended up getting pushed in there. But what, during those 3 months, we were trying to figure out, all right, how do we differentiate ourselves from, you know, our competitors? And, you know, we thought of the presence of a lot of different pharmaceutical and healthcare industry partners in the Raleigh area of North Carolina. And so we were fortunate to be connected with folks like Zipline, Matternet, who I would, you know, embarrassingly, I kept saying Matterhorn every time I meet with them. They're like, no, it's Matternet Basel. Luckily, they didn't hold that against me and still were part of our proposal. But we, you know, Matternet was operating in Switzerland at the time. Zipline was operating in Africa. And so we pulled them onto our team and we said, all right, we want to focus on medical package delivery. And then there were a couple others that wanted to join as well. Flytrex, which is an Israeli company that was delivering food, in Holly Springs, which is a local town there. And then we got really lucky. We actually had Apple on our team as well. And so we felt like we had a pretty strong proposal. There were a couple folks that we were told we probably want to avoid, which you can guess who those companies were. Because they weren't picked up on any of the proposals. And so we decided, all right, we'll remove some of those folks. And so we submitted our proposal. And frankly, I'll have to mention AirMap and give them a lot of credit. I mean, if you notice, AirMap was on, like, I think 8 of the 10 that were selected. And, you know, we really worked closely with AirMap to figure out what do we really think the FAA wants. And so we were selected as part of the 10 participants, and that kicked off in June of 2018. And so that wrapped up October of last year, October of 2020. And so we had about, you know, 2.5 years. It was really a 3-year program. Once we got up and running, it was about 2.5 years. And some of our accomplishments there was, you asked about what was my role. So I was at the time, UAS program manager. So I kind of led the whole program for the North Carolina Department of Transportation, and then led that whole initiative as well for the integration pilot program. And I had a couple other folks that helped me out with that. One of those was Tom Davis, who I got connected with. He had just retired from NASA, had a full career at NASA, knew how to partner with FAA. And was interested in drones. He moved from California to Raleigh. And so he joined our team. And then we had Dash. I think you had Dash on here a little while ago, Dash Devakarin. Yep. And others that were helping support this effort, Randy Breedlove. He's a name known in North Carolina. He had a full career at FAA as well. So we had a really good kind of administrative team, and then we got really fortunate to have great team partners. So at the end of that 3 years, we were able to have the first routine medical package delivery operation established here in North Carolina. So in March of 2019, UPS started flying with Matternet at Wake Med, and they flew Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, every hour on the hour. And we got a lot of data from that particular flight. UPS got their 135. They actually had the first 135 drone delivery operation in North Carolina with UPS. An interesting fact about that is they had an all-women crew that that conducted that first flight. So two women pilots and a mechanic. And so it's pretty exciting to think back, like the first official, you know, kind of drone delivery flight under this section, Part 135, was all women. And, you know, congratulate UPS for kind of understanding the importance of having more women in aviation, especially in UAS. And then we also had some other great accomplishments. We were able to use drones to help with the COVID pandemic. So Zipline was flying for Novant. They're flying PPE down in Kannapolis. And then we had Valancy flying for Merck. Merck is a pharmaceutical company, and they were flying vaccines from their pharmaceutical plant to a local clinic. And those, again, they're all routine flights. These were like on schedule, happening, you know, every day or Monday through Friday. And then we had UPS flying in Winston-Salem as well with Wake Forest Baptist Hospital delivering infusions. So, you know, there was a infusion they would mix up in the pharmacy. You had to be infused in your body within 1 hour. They put it on a drone, fly it over to the clinic where you would take that infusion. And then on the way back, they'd be able to fly specimens and blood samples. And then also we kind of pivoted in working with Flytrex and Causey Aviation. Walmart launched a few locations. So we had, you know, Walmart using drone delivery to deliver from a local store to a neighborhood near that store. And when we think about the impacts there for COVID, you know, folks were sheltering in place. And so I don't know about you guys, but I was using DoorDash, Grubhub a lot more than I would have pre-COVID, especially since a lot of the restaurants were closed. And now this was another mechanism with the drone delivery to deliver, you know, critical items that you may need from a Walmart and including some local restaurants to your home. So we were really excited when we looked at the data at the end of that program. You know, we were around, well, over half of the flights that were submitted under that program came from North Carolina. We're competing, of course, with 9 others for that. So we got, again, this is not me bragging at all. It's really the partners we had and the customers that were willing to pay for their service that really made that a success.
I think it's awesome. I mean, a lot of times when even on this show, when we spoke to people previously, Texas kind of serves as one of the states that is very at the front line of using drones for commercial purposes. But if I just hear you list all these projects in North Carolina, there's been a lot going on in North Carolina. I think that's really amazing. I want to start talking about the Beyond program. But before we go there, you mentioned that Apple got involved as well. Can you tell us more about how and why Apple got involved in the IPP in North Carolina?
Yeah, so there's a legislative affairs officer, I guess is what his official title was, that was actually from North Carolina that worked at Apple. And so during this proposal process, you know, Google Wing was someone else we reached out to, but I was like, I don't know if anyone's talking to Apple. And I had no idea if they're even flying drones. And it turned out they were flying drones. They're very secretive about, of course, a lot of what they did. And so it was like pulling teeth just to get something on a proposal that, you know, they were willing for us to share. It was like pulling teeth just to get, you know, any information out of them. But they definitely were interested in kind of being on the proposal and being part of this program. There are a lot of unknowns. And so what we wrote in our proposal was that they were very interested in, you know, gathering data from different platforms, including drones, to help serve their Maps app. So if you remember when Apple launched Maps, it kind of fell flat, right? And so they're like, we got to figure out other ways we can collect data and just, you know, and you know, improve the traffic and, you know, modeling that we have on our platform. And so, you know, drones was one of those platforms that they were interested in gathering that data. We got selected. And once we started getting, you know, flights up and running, we asked them if they wanted to come to North Carolina and fly. And they're like, well, really, we're, you know, they're focused on a couple other areas that they wanted to fly in California and up along the West Coast. And, you know, we're telling them, well, you actually kind of have to fly North Carolina to be part of the, the program. That's kind of the focus for North Carolina. And they're like, oh, okay, well, So it turned out we never were able to get them to come out and fly during those 3 years. And, you know, just, you know, I think it was recently that, right, there was a patent that just got released where we continue to see Apple move in the space, right, in this drone space. So that's about all I know, you know, when it comes to peeling the curtain behind the scenes of what Apple's doing with drones. They're definitely interested in working on it, but we never got to fly in North Carolina.
Yeah, I know that for Apple, improving their maps has been a big deal and continues to be a big deal. So it makes sense for them to be interested in drones, I guess. Now that the original IPP program is a done deal, basically, and they've moved on to the Beyond program, I understand that you play a role in that as well. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Beyond program from the FAA is about and what you guys are doing in North Carolina?
Yeah, so as the IPP or the Integration Pilot Program kind of wrapped up, they recognized they hadn't really met, you know, a lot of the goals they wanted to. For example, they wanted to fly beyond visual line of sight. And so one of the things I didn't mention that we did under the IPP was we got the first beyond visual line of sight bridge waiver. So this was like the first kind of true BB loss waiver. A lot of the BB loss waivers we see, you still have to have someone clearing the airspace, right? They still need to be looking around to make sure there's no aircraft coming in. So you're just waiving the fact that you have to see the drone. Well, you know, for this, we were not going to be able to see the drone, and we didn't really want to clear the airspace either, since we were flying underneath the bridge. And so we were able to get that approval. I will have to say that that was an interesting waiver to get. You know, our when we were getting that waiver, you know, you're talking to FAA and talking about the safety case you have. They're like, well, I really think you need someone that's just looking around to make sure no aircraft are approaching. And we're like, we're flying under the bridge. Like, no one's flying under a bridge with an airplane. Well, as it turns out, sure enough, a lady in Ohio flies underneath a bridge and then gets in trouble with the FAA over it. And so anyhow, we end up getting that waiver with nobody to have to clear the airspace. It was really a true BV loss waiver. But there was only a handful of waivers like that under the IPP program that were approved. And so back to your question about Beyond was going to look at just that, beyond visual line of sight. How do we really commercialize beyond visual line of sight? And they started this work with these partners. So they said, sure, let's continue this work. It'll be under a new name because, of course, the presidential memorandum, you know, said that they had to stop the IPP. So they stopped the IPP. They invited all the participants that were on the IPP to the Beyond program. At that time, there were only 9. One of the original 10 had dropped out, and that was the Lee County Mosquito District in Florida. They dropped out. And then of the 9 that were asked to participate, 8 transferred over. City of San Diego, which was on the IPP, didn't end up joining the Beyond program. And so the Beyond program has been really kind of a continuation for us in North Carolina. All the same partners we had on the original IPP program, we added to our Beyond program. And then we've also added a few new ones as well, including, you know, recently we've added X-Wing. So if you're familiar with X-Wing, if you watch any of the Star Wars series, X-Wing, as you know, is the is where they're taking, you know, existing type certified aircraft and putting, you know, some automation and remotely piloting them. And so we're excited to both have small drones, right, you know, 55 pounds and under, and, you know, larger ones all the way up to kind of, you know, potentially flying this caravan, Cessna caravan, that's optionally piloted in our airspace. And my role now, I'm contracted back to lead that program. So I'm the Beyond program manager there at North Carolina DOT. And it's kind of, it's really just a part-time role that I fill as we continue to work toward our goals under the Beyond program.
I think it's so awesome that it was all women who did that maiden UPS delivery flight. I had no idea. So thank you for sharing that. I think that's super cool. We'll have to have some of them on the show. But getting on to it, a big portion of integrating UAS into national airspace relies on remote ID. So can you just tell us what role you think remote ID is just going to play in that goal going forward?
Yeah, there's been a lot of hype around remote ID as, you know, I think back to some of the conversations we had in the early days of the IPP when we talked about being able to fly beyond visual line of sight. And so some of the comments we were getting back from FAA was, well, we got to figure out this remote ID, you know, what that requirement is going to look like. And of course, it's out now, and we have some requirements in place for when everyone needs to be broadcasting in the future. I think this is a really great step forward for the industry as a whole. You know, when we think about UTM, well, there's a lot of different things. So maybe I'll start with even at a local level. You know, we've seen a lot of state and local governments enact laws around UAS. And so, you know, there's obviously a lot of legitimate concerns. You know, in North Carolina, there's a law around, you know, using a flying a drone near a prison. We've seen drones and have captured and have, you know, documented drones being used to smuggle contraband into prisons. And so that's an example of, you know, the role that remote ID could potentially play in the future in helping understand drones flying around these confinement facilities or prisons. Sometimes these are right in the middle of cities, right? And there's other folks that want to be flying. You know, maybe an energy company wants to be flying because they're inspecting a line. And so if they're able to broadcast, you know, who they are and their intention, someone like a correctional facility will be able to understand, all right, this is not someone we need to worry about. It's a, you know, it's a utility company flying here. But if someone should be broadcasting and they see a drone and they're not broadcasting, there's going to be more concern and focus on that particular individual. So that's kind of at a, you know, a local level. But when we think about building this UTM system, we kind of needed somewhere to start as well. And so folks being able to broadcast again who they are and their intentions is going to be very helpful as well. And so we're trying to figure out a way to integrate that now into kind of the entire system. What sensors do we need to have on the ground? Or, you know, is it going to be through a network? And I think, you know, having sensors on the ground in a city, understanding where folks are flying will be very helpful for a variety of different reasons. Again, public safety at a local level, as well as kind of figuring out how we can fly beyond visual line of sight in the future. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of potential, and we're excited to see the adoption. I will note that, you know, remote ID came out. We have a couple of partners we're working with, in the certification process to get their UAS certified. And so again, they're gonna have to go back and see how do they add on that, you know, correct module for their particular, platform that's being certified. So, overall, I think it's a great, you know, progress for the industry. I think it's great, again, for local and state governments as well, kind of have an understanding of what's happening in their community.
Any major partners that you can reveal or we should know about?
Well, we're still under NDA with, I think, all of them, so not quite yet. We can share.
All right.
It's all good. Now, you mentioned remote ID. The location of the aircraft is critical for, you know, the integration into the airspace. How about the location of the pilot, which is, you know, one of the very controversial piece of the regulation where the location of the pilot is going to be available to the general public. Do you think that can create an issue for the drone pilots getting harassed because their location is broadcasted to everyone and anyone?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I don't know. Well, there's a couple of comments I'll make. You know, we talk with folks like the UPS and others that are doing drone delivery, Zipline and COSDI, Aviation and Flytrex and Valancy. Honestly, their plan in the long term is to have a pilot, you know, remotely at a place that they're operating multiple drones, right? And so in some cases, like drone delivery, the pilot location, they could be flying, let's say, in Winston-Salem, but the pilot location for that aircraft may be in, you know, it could be on the West Coast, it could be in DC, it could be where you are. So it may not be within close proximity to where the operation is taking place. But, you know, I think when we think about other operations, like utility inspection or tower inspection or real estate photography, I think there needs to be some questions asked about, like you said, the safety of an individual, especially when the police maybe are called or public safety is involved. I mean, we've talked with a lot of local public safety officials in North Carolina. When I was wearing the hat of UAS program manager, we get calls about, hey, there's a drone flying over my house. I want to know who's flying it. And, you know, we'll talk to the police and they'll say, we don't know who's flying it. Like, do you have any recommendations? And of course, the recommendation at the time is, yeah, more than likely, it's not going to fly for longer than 20 minutes. So just hang around and see where the drone goes and lands. And that's probably where you'll find the individual. So I think if it depends on who has access to that data. I do think there's value in, of course, public safety having access to that data. But I'm not entirely sure that it's going to be super valuable for individuals. So I guess I'm really kind of treading around your question. To be honest, it's a good question that I don't think I really have the right answer for.
No, I understand. I don't think any of us have the answer, quite frankly. So,
yeah, I think one of the problems here is that remote ID is almost like a one size fits all situation, right? And I think if you look at the different use cases for drones, I mean, if you look at Google with Wing, for instance, or you look at what Amazon is planning on doing, and you compare that to, let's say, hobbyist drone pilots or FPV drone pilots. I mean, we're flying drones in very different ways and in very different circumstances with also very different kinds of drones. And I think remote ID right now doesn't really allow for all those different use cases because they have like one solution that is supposed to fit for everybody. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, it's a great comment. You know, one of the things we heard from you know, the drone delivery partners, what they're concerned about broadcasting their location and people being able to understand, you know, where, how many neighborhoods that they're flying to and aggregating a lot of that data about flights, right? And and how that intelligence from all that data aggregation would help, you know, their competitors. And it's interesting because there are folks that will follow, you know, transponder and ADS-B, well, really ADS-B and follow where these large corporations, their jets are flying because they want to know, you know, potential mergers and acquisitions, that what company are they talking to they might potentially merge with, because they want to obviously buy that company, some stock in that company before it's purchased by another large company because that value could go up. So there's a lot that you can do with that data when it comes to the commercial side. But we, you know, we definitely want to encourage folks to fly recreationally and I think undo burden on folks that are flying for fun. We want to be very careful of, because lots of us that got into this industry, and again, this wasn't me, but others that I know flew for fun, right? I fly for fun now too. I have a drone that I fly just with my kids, but a lot of folks to get into this industry, they flew for fun and they realized this is a really great tool that I can use for a variety of different things. And so we want to make sure that we don't have a high hurdle or barrier to entry for the technology that's required for these folks to enjoy drone, you know, flying as a hobbyist and where they can fly, right? So obviously FRIAs, as you know, areas that are designated for folks that don't have to have remote ID, is an area they can fly, but you know, lots of other questions to answer around that. But yeah, the one size fits all, I think, is maybe classic FAA, you know, mm-hmm. applying Part 135, which is unscheduled air carrier service. Think of your, you know, your typical chartered aircraft. Applying that to drone delivery is not a, you know, this is another example of we're just going to take something we have and try to apply it to as many things as we can.
So do you think drone deliveries will help make drones more accepted to the public?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think medical package delivery has really helped with that perception. So, you know, we think about retail package delivery to your home. There's certainly folks that would be potentially annoyed by someone getting a drone, delivering a bunch of stuff to their house, and any noise, which I know is very low impact to them or visually seeing it. But if, you know, starting with drone delivery for medical use cases where we're saying, hey, we're potentially saving a life by this delivery, or we're improving healthcare outcomes, I think that was our focus under IPP. And I think that was what really got folks excited about drone delivery. And there's a lot we can learn from having these fixed locations within a medical campus or kind of a medical network to start delivering items for customers like these healthcare institutions who are willing to pay. And then some of the lessons learned from that can certainly be applied to retail kind of package delivery. So you have to look at kind of the whole picture. I mean, you know, lots of other use cases we can think about, like, flying critical tools are critical components out to someone who's working in the field. We think about, drone delivery to the oil platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, or someone's deep in the woods and you're using a drone to deliver, a critical item that they need, whether that's, they need it personally for their health, or they need it for their vehicle or car, or something broke down. We see a lot of potential. And then, of course, natural disasters, whether that's the devastating wildfires or, earthquakes, or even, in North Carolina, we had a lot of hurricanes. There's a great use case for delivering critical items via drone delivery as well. So this is kind of all of the same equipment can be used in those different missions. And so it just helps, the more operations we can fly, builds this ecosystem and lowers the price, because at the end of the day, we will have to make a decision. If I'm ordering something from Amazon, do I want this today via drone delivery, or can I wait for next day or 2 day? And so we need to get the cost low enough that it's really competitive.
And a follow-up I have on this is, I've heard some concerns voiced that as drone deliveries become more common, it could potentially restrict flights for recreational or even commercial operators that aren't in delivery. Do you agree with that? Do you think there's going to be a threat at all? Or is it going to impact where people can fly, especially in urban areas?
Yeah.
I would add.
I think definitely in urban areas, we'd have to look at the data. I'll be honest, there's a lot of airspace out there. And when we think about package delivery, they are going to definitely be at a higher, they already have to meet a higher bar of safety, including the ability to detect where other aircraft are. And so back to my kind of previous point, we're just going to have to see where the numbers shake out and what someone's going to be willing to pay for will really drive the adoption of who will be ordering and having things delivered to their homes. And so if the numbers are not as high as we think they are, this may not be an issue, right? And then I think it's important, though, if I'm a company that's doing drone delivery and I know that there's an area that, is an established FRIA, or it is an area, where folks are allowed to or focus on flying drones or, flying clubs or parks, you're going to want to avoid those areas as well, so that you can deliver the packages. But I think that, really it's going to be on the drone delivery companies to ensure that they're operating in a safe manner, especially if they're flying beyond visual line of sight. I don't know if that is going to be a concern or not. We're just going to have to see how many people, it's going to be competing with a lot of things like autonomous vehicles on the ground delivering food in the future. They're looking at these kind of small terrestrial robots and that are, on the sidewalk now as well. So there's going to be a lot of competition in this drone space for drone delivery.
So you're very involved with UAM, urban air mobility, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes here. Do you think UAM combined with the impact of large scale operation like drone delivery, for example, is going to have an impact on noise especially in urban environments? Is this something that you have been concerned with or that you're working towards, or see any projects that are working on that?
Yeah, so I don't think noise is going to be a concern. I think traditionally in aviation, we think about noise, and it's been a huge focus, really ever since the turbine engine. Even before the turbine engine, because we have a court case here in North Carolina where there was someone flying into a Navy base, I think, and the guys' chickens were being scared from the noise. But noise certainly has always been an issue around airports. I saw that before I got into drones working on the airport side. And so naturally, folks think of the noise associated with drones or even eVTOLs. But there's a couple things that I think are driving why they're not as noisy. One is they're obviously lighter. And then they're electric powered. And so you're getting a reduction in obviously a turbine engine, and they're lighter. So it's not as heavy of an aircraft, which, as we know, the heavier aircraft gets, it's also going to be louder, especially for, rotors on a helicopter. And they've made some improvements on, of course, the blade design as well. But we would, all of these places I mentioned in North Carolina that we've been flying, I've been to the sites, I've seen them. And as soon as they transition out of kind of, the vertical takeoff or landing portion and start flying, you can't even hear them. And you really can't hear them in urban areas. So I think of that first flight at Wake Med where they're flying routinely. I mean, they're flying over roads and you would really have to listen hard to be able to pick it up. But there's a lot of other ambient noise that's being picked up. And then, one other thing I didn't mention was in January of 2000 or in January of 2020, was it 2019? It's all blending together now. We partnered with EHang. It was 2020. EHang to fly their eVTOL. So if you remember EHang 216, it has 16 propellers on it. It's electric powered. And, that was really silent. I mean, it was a lot quieter than a helicopter. And so, again, I think about the noise is primarily in that takeoff or landing portion of the flight. But when they're transitioning in flight and flying, they're very, the noise impact is really not there. And you've seen this from Joby, right? Joby had the video where Joe Ben was out there and he's talking to the camera and their aircraft is taking off behind him and it's really quiet. You talked about initiatives, and under the Beyond program, we actually, FAA came out and did some testing in Liberty, North Carolina, and we flew three different drones, and it was a complete setup. I think there was probably 12 or more microphones they had arrayed. We had a crane there that had microphones hanging off of, of the crane all the way up to 100 feet, and it was the noise profile process that they use for everything from, F-35s to helicopters. And so we followed that same procedure and flew three different platforms there so they could gather that data. So we're waiting on FAA to kind of, this was this summer, they've told us they're looking through that data and they're developing noise profiles. And so we'll be able to see like really what is the decibel level and how does this noise impact fit into their traditional models of how they, model noise in communities. They've done that for years with airports and then helicopters and your traditional aircraft. So I'm hoping we're going to get some good guidance from FAA soon around that.
Good to hear.
So we started talking about urban air mobility. Can you explain to our audience what that's all about, what kind of aircraft are involved and what the challenges are and where basically the technology is nowadays?
Yeah, so urban air mobility has changed its name recently. It's now called Advanced Air Mobility, and really this is the electrification of aircraft and flying, really serving areas that have not been served by traditional aircraft. So we think of where helicopters have traditionally played a role, or small aircraft moving people have played a role flying in and out of general aviation airports. This new vertical and takeoff capability of electric platform that can potentially carry passengers, but also can carry freight and a variety of other things, is really disrupting how we're going to be moving in, for example, urban areas. So that's why I kind of started out as urban air mobility. But they recognize there's a great potential for rural areas too. We think of, again, I'll go back to healthcare. We think of folks that are in that are mobility impaired that live in rural areas. And we've seen kind of a centralization of healthcare institutions, flying an eVTOL out and landing close to them where they can get on that aircraft and fly to a hospital or to a clinic to you know, have access to healthcare, I think is a great use case. So NASA saw, look, let's expand it beyond urban air mobility to kind of, you know, this regional aspect as well, and kind of changed it to AAM. And so everything, I guess, from in my perspective, and again, this kind of is also NASA kind of coined the term of AAM, you know, it's everything from drones all the way up to kind of to the larger platforms that we would traditionally call air taxi systems, so moving people. So the state of the industry, well, we've seen a ton of money dumped. I shouldn't say dumped. It's been invested. We've seen a ton of money invested into this industry. I mean, you know, we had two SPACs just in the last year, both Joby and Archer going public via a SPAC. You know, this is in the billions of dollars that we're seeing invested into this space. And so kind of the big hurdle right now we see is certification. And we also see this on the UAS side, kind of the drone side. But these systems like Joby and Archer and Lilium and Volocopter and others need to be certified. And FAA is really trying to wrap their head around, how do we certify an electric vehicle, and how do we certify a vertical or takeoff landing, you know, electric vehicle? So it's totally outside of their box, and they're having to think very, you know, outside the box and about this new innovative technology. So we don't have anyone that's certified to fly those platforms yet. So a lot of testing going on, and we're also seeing a pretty large investment by the military in the space as well. And through programs like Agility Prime, they want to help take that burden of certification and unknown, the unknown of making it through certification. They want to take a little bit of that burden off of them and put them under contract with the Department of Defense and work with them to develop a vertical flight capability within the military. So, so really, Department of Defense is helping kind of this AAM space. And the numbers we hear, the dates we hear is, you know, potentially we'll see flights next year. But I think if you're asking me, I don't think we'll see flights until 2025. When I say flights, I mean routine flights where people are flying, again, with certified vehicles. I know there's folks like Lyft that are flying under the ultralight rules, but I think we're still, you know, 2 to 3 years away.
So I have a follow-up.
I'd be curious to what your guys' opinion. I would be curious to what your guys' opinion are, because, you know, you're obviously in this space as well. And often we hear, oh, we're just around the corner. But, you know, realistically, I don't know, what are your guys' thoughts about how far away we are?
Well, that might tie into my follow-up question as well. I mean, with the drone industry itself moving so fast, and then we're not even talking about urban air mobility and all the air taxis and stuff, is the FAA really equipped to follow up as quickly as that industry is moving forward and breaking new grounds? And I wonder if they are. I mean, I think you already see that with remote ID, where we have a one-size-fits-all approach. I think the FAA is behind the developments, and it takes them years to get to remote ID for drones. With the other things that are changing, like urban air mobility, I just wonder how they're going to catch up. And I guess then secondly, it comes to the question, when do they catch up? So I think it's going to be years as well. I mean, we heard Jeff Bezos say, what was it, in 2013, I think, that drone deliveries would become a routine experience for people. And now here we are in 2021. It's far from being routine. It's happening for sure, but it's not as widespread. So that's my opinion. What do you think? Is the FAA equipped to move as quickly as needed to support this fast growing industry?
No, I don't think they are. And you know, we've worked closely with FAA, and we worked with some really great people there. But they certainly are resource constrained when it comes to integrating UAS in. But then also, there's just kind of, they were never really set up for a technology that evolves as quickly. You know, we think about traditional aircraft and it being a 10-year process to roll out a new airliner or a new aircraft. And, well, shoot, every 12 months we're seeing a new model of a drone coming out. And so the partners that, you know, we're working with on the Beyond program that are going through the certification process, Matternet, Zipline, and Flytrex, you know, they've been working on this since the IPP. So they're already about 3 years in, and they still, you know, I'm not sure if we see a light at the end of the tunnel for them to be certified. And what's happened is, because it's so new, you know, every time you kind of turn a stone over, you find something else. Oh, well, we didn't even think about this. Oh, we didn't even think about it. Do we need to certify the ground control station to the same standards that we need to the aircraft that's flying in the sky? You know, that's something that happened just this year. They had to make a decision on that. So there's lots of kind of processes and procedures that I think are holding them back as well. And then, you know, there's also this other component that is the ability for them to take on any type of risk. And so we think about this, well, we definitely saw this when we were getting waivers. They were definitely risk adverse, but if we're trying to integrate, you know, a technology that's advanced, and there are going to be some unknowns, we don't know all of the capabilities, but we want to be able to integrate it. So we build that data. And so if we can't approve a flight to fly beyond visual line of sight or over people to build the reliability data, well, then we're not going to make any progress. So I think those are the three things that are really holding them back. One is just resources, so just having the manpower. The second is processes and procedures to actually work with a new innovative technology. And then the third is kind of being so risk adverse that it really kind of hampers the progress.
So you've been involved
One more question that I want to...
Okay, go for it, Haya.
Can I squeeze one in, Kara? There's so much to talk about here, I think.
Yes.
I think what you see happening is that, and Zipline, I think, is a great example. I mean, where is most of their drone delivery flights taking place? It's happening in Africa. And a big reason for that is that the regulation isn't as strict over there as it is here in the United States. Mm-hmm. So apart from the FAA having a hard time dealing with a industry that's moving so rapidly, I think there's also a risk of new innovation just moving out of this country and developing elsewhere. And it might be in Africa, could be anywhere in the world, where regulations aren't so strict. Is that something, Basil, you think we should be worried about? Is that innovation and technology and therefore talent as well moves out of the US to areas where drone technology is being used more widely and in more innovative ways?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. Well, there's a couple things I think to unpeel here. So one, you're definitely... So we have let's take the Zipline example. So we have a US-based company that's operating overseas. They're building a product here, but they're having to operate overseas to understand, you know, and improve the product. You know, their goal, of course, is to fly in the US at some point. Now, yeah. In Africa, they don't have the same traffic density as we do here in the US. So they can be a little bit more lenient. And then something that really kind of is either, I don't know if I'd say hinders the US, but it's just part of the fabric of this aviation community, is we have a Class G airspace, which is uncontrolled airspace. And I can go out there and fly, and I don't have to talk to anybody. And I can just look around outside, you know, out of my aircraft. And as long as I don't hit anyone else, I can fly in that, no issue at all. And that's not found in a whole lot of places in the world. And in addition, I don't even need a license to fly. And some, I could, you know, under these ultralight rules, I could go get a parachute and a backpack that has a lawnmower engine that's spinning a blade, and it's considered a vehicle by FAA. And as long as I don't fly in controlled airspace, I can fly around as well. And so having that access to our airspace, both for, you know, at a recreational level, in the Class G airspace is great, right? That's great. We can get more folks flying with less cost in, you know, what the technology they're required. And so this is kind of the position you've seen AOPA take. But that also opens up a lot of questions on how do we fly drones in that same space. And so I do think that's why we see a lot of folks going overseas. One reason is they can work with a regulator directly in maybe an area that's not as congested as the US and fly, that's willing to, you know, partner with someone and take some risk. In the case of Zipline flying to Rwanda, I mean, they were able to just provide tremendous improvements to how they distributed blood by those operations. So there's a huge benefit for them there. And then, you know, your question about, are we going to lose talent to go overseas? I think we still see folks wanting, you know, the U.S. is where aviation started with the Wright brothers on the Outer Banks of North Carolina. You know, we've long had a leading position. I think our position is maybe called into question a little bit after the Boeing, you know, issue, 737 MAX issue. And, you know, I think we are going to potentially get behind. Well, we already are in some ways, I think, behind on the, on integrating UAS. But I think folks are still going to want to come to the U.S. because it's going to be the largest market. And we're known for, you know, being innovative. So I'm hoping we're not going to lose folks on a lot of startups that I've talked to. You know, they're also outside of the U.S. They definitely want to have a presence in the U.S. because they know if they can get their drone certified or their platform certified in the U.S., they can go to almost any other country in the world and hold up that certificate and be accepted. So we just got to keep that gold standard.
So you have been involved in several efforts as far as educating younger generations on the aviation industry. What does that entail and why is it important to you?
Yeah, we've been, you know, really fortunate to work with youth, getting them excited about science in general, STEM or STEAM as it's called now, with adding arts in there, and getting folks excited, just getting them exposed to what their opportunities are after school or just exposed to technology in general, is something that I'm definitely really passionate about and excited because, I've talked to a lot of folks that have gotten into aviation or the UAS industry and they can pinpoint it to a certain conversation or a certain experience. Just talking with someone, you know, a few weeks ago and they were working, you know, in high school, they went and visited an air traffic control center and had no idea, you know, they'd never flown on a plane before in their life, but that particular experience really got them excited about aviation. And they ended up having an entire career in aviation. And so, so that's why I think it's really important to get kids excited about science, using drones, and in aviation in general. And, you know, one thing I'm definitely passionate about is just getting, you know, a broader group of folks, a more diverse group of folks in aviation as well. So getting, you know, folks like I have three daughters, my daughter's excited about aviation. We definitely want to see more women in this space. And, you know, if we can, you know, my goal is that if we can, you know, have a diverse group of folks in aviation, the same diverse group that aviation feeds, whether it's in the airline industry or on the, you know, UAS side, we want to make sure everyone is included as we think about building this new ecosystem around advanced air mobility. So one of the, you know, one of the initiatives that we've helped out with is these summer camps, STEM summer camps. We just wrapped up one this year with LAWA, which is the Los Angeles World Airports. We had Greg. Greg came out. He actually gave away a couple of his Part 107 classes, which is pretty exciting to some of those high school students. And, you know, during those conversations, I'm always impressed. You know, these kids are thinking way ahead. They're thinking outside the box. You know, we need these kids in FAA in the future, to your point about getting them to adapt. You know, they're thinking of all kinds of different use cases that we hadn't even thought of.
Yeah.
And again, it's this going to future generation that's going to help build this new ecosystem. And so another kind of focus that we've had is our podcast. We also have a podcast mm-hmm. called No U-Turn. And in that, we're trying to, you know, well, we just talk about transportation broadly. But some of the funds that we're raising through that podcast, we're developing a scholarship for folks that after high school, you know, to be able to get their Part 107 license or get into different aviation programs. So, you know, it's important to give back. I've been very fortunate to be where I am in my career and taking a little bit of what I have and giving back both my time and resources, I think is super important. And it just feels good, right? It feels really good to do it too.
So we're getting towards the end of the show, and we really appreciate your time in answering all these questions. There's just so many topics that you're involved with that it's been hard to really pinpoint only one. But we always have one final question, which is, what is your favorite drone?
Oof. What is my favorite drone? Okay, so the favorite drone I have right now, I'll tell you my favorite drone, and then I'll tell you what drone I'm excited about. Hopefully my wife listens to this and I pick this up this holiday season. But my favorite drone I fly now is a Parrot Disco. I don't know, you're familiar with this? It's like a fixed wing made out of styrofoam, really light, but styrofoam, it is a blast to, it's a blast to fly. And, you know, it comes with goggles. Of course, you got to have a visual observer, make sure if you're flying under part 107, you're maintaining the visual line of sight, but you can just get that thing down and it gets screaming across the ground. And, that has been the most fun, drone I've flown. I'm looking forward to, my first, well, I have a small FPV drone now, but I want to get a much larger FPV drone. It's just impressive, these cinematic FPV shots I've seen. Like, it's amazing. And I hopefully can reproduce some of those. I know, Kara, you're doing some great things on with photography and drones. And I don't know if you've gotten into the FPV yet, but I'm just super impressed by not only your photos, but others that are taking these incredible shots. And so that's a hobby I want to start pursuing.
Oh, thank you so much. I will admit that the first time I switched a DJI FPV drone into manual mode, it crashed. I tell anyone, it is an entirely different experience. And I talked to a few other fellow reviewers and they said, oh, well, my rep sent me two, because they were just expecting that to happen. I don't think people realize how difficult it is, because you're just constantly maneuvering the joysticks. You're not hovering unless you're in normal or sport mode with the DJI FPV drone. But a typical FPV drone, though, you are constantly maneuvering. And so I know Drone Racing League has a simulator, and DJI created one. And I just tell people, go spend time in that simulation or learn to build something lightweight that if it crashes, it's more resilient. While DJI has done a lot of great things with their FPV drone, if you do crash it, it's very likely that you are going to send it in and you should have DJI care as well. But that is something I do want to get really good at, because Cola FPV, Johnny FPV are just creating some phenomenal shots. And Johnny FPV just actually created a commercial with Mercedes. And so seeing artists like Justin Bieber and major brands embrace FPV drones is just really encouraging. So I think it's something
who
we
did
should
the,
all...
Who did the commercial for the bowling alley where they're flying through that bowling alley?
Jaybird Christensen.
Have you seen this one recently? Oh my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
That
I actually covered
blew
it
my mind.
Review. Yeah, and that was
oh, that's great.
I can't remember the model he used, but more of a lightweight and just something that he actually, when you see it go in, I think to the bowling pin area, he placed it in there, the drone fell in there, and then he was just able to get it out and keep flying. So just more of a resilient model. I can't believe the model is, I'm blanking on it right now, but yes, Jaybird Christensen does some phenomenal work. Him and his company, I think they're based out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yeah, they started a whole new trend of drone flying. So, all right. Well, Basil, we really appreciate your time today and talking to us about everything that you're involved with. It's definitely been a pleasure. For those of you that are interested in more information, Basil is on LinkedIn. They also have the No U-Turn podcast that you can listen to on your favorite podcast provider. I tell you, I don't listen to many podcasts. I think I have 3 or 4, but you guys are definitely on my list. So I listen to you when I run and when I do stuff around the house. And if you enjoyed the Pixel Drone Show, make sure that you subscribe. subscribe and share on social media as well. And we air every new show every Tuesday, and we can be found on podcast platforms and on YouTube. So thanks, everyone. You have a great day, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.